तस्स भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स नमो तस्स भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स नमो तस्स भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स बुद्धं धम्मं संघं नमस्सामि। So it always feels like quite an honor to be teaching in front of so many people and so many experienced practitioners, quite humbling. So we notice how we can be influenced so positively by the weather. Now having a blue sky above one's head to makes a difference, doesn't it? If you notice it, of course. Sometimes one can be maybe so depressed or miserable that you might not even know the weather is bright. Just like the mind can be bright, or it can be obscured by many unpleasant things, unpleasant feelings, unpleasant perceptions, unpleasant memories, and disappointed expectations, disappointed by the fact that life is not the way we expect it to be, or so this is life, nothing special. Human life is like that. But for most people, when you don't know the reality of life, then it can be very disturbing. You know, when you want something, you don't get it. When you don't expect something to come your way, you get it. Maybe unpleasant things, you suddenly bump into somebody you don't want to see, or a situation that's just difficult, that brings unpleasant feelings in you. So when we study the mind, when we get interested in studying the human mind, then it's a long path. It's not something that the result of studying the mind might not come overnight, as one expects, perhaps, thinking that it's easy, or it's I should have results, instant result, or if it's not fast enough, then maybe it's not worth it. So this is why the Buddha put patience at the sort of the top of the list of the most important discipline, you know, kanti. Interestingly enough, it's like from the Buddha's point of view, realization and knowledge, this quality of patience, kanti, is is far higher than, let's say, ascetic practices such as fasting or sleeping on the bed of nails. Like maybe some Indian practices used to be. Existed in India in the time of the Buddha, or not talking maybe for a whole year, or just fasting for long periods and so on, you know, or doing some extraordinary things to challenge one's attachments. Patience comes first. Now, when I was young, I thought patience was the kind of thing you don't have to do anything. In fact, when you're young, you can't really see even that you're impatient. It's just normal. I have to get things really fast, quick, now. And I used to think, oh, you only get patient when you're so old, there's nothing you can do anymore, you just have to wait all the time. You can't move so fast, you can't think so fast, you can't get things so fast. So I had this illusion that you become patient when there's nothing else you can do. And it was quite interesting for me to see that this quality of the mind is absolutely essential. And this is worth reflecting. Why is this quality of mind so essential, so vital, so central to the Buddhist path? Well, when we study the mind, we enter a field of great complexities. You know, when you read the Buddhist teaching, maybe not for everybody, it makes so much sense. It's so clear. It's so obvious. Read on a piece of paper on a nice evening when you feel good, Buddhist teaching makes total sense. It's easy to understand, almost childlike teaching. You know, there is suffering, there is an end of suffering, there's things are impermanent. There is good feeling, bad feeling, neutral feeling. There is, pleasant and unpleasant, and so on. So on a piece of paper, as you read it in a nice environment and feeling good, that sort of make you believe that it's not so difficult. But when you study the mind, then you enter a realm of exploration which is riddled with paradoxes. You know, you go fast, go slowly. That's one of the things I remember, you know. If you want to go fast, just go slowly. You know, people will not understand, you know, a sense of two words opposing each other because the mind is still very identified with a rational brain. You know, the rational brain can only think in terms of opposites. It doesn't know how to think in terms of, in fact, doesn't have the faculty, I think, to think without opposites. That's just my experience. Of course, you can think in terms of the graduation between the one side of the brain or one side of, and the other side. You can have many adjectives and verbs and concepts that express the kind of slow graduation going from hell to heaven, or going from happiness to unhappiness, or misery to joy, and so on. So you get this kind of knowledge when you experience and study the mind. Many of us here who have been in the practice for a long time might remember that what I remember was that my best cup of tea was the most disgusting cup of tea, for example. The most horrible cup of tea, if I hadn't been kind of in a position where that was the only cup of tea I could have, and I was very happy to drink something hot, that was my best cup of tea. But if I had been thinking and I had many choices, I would have been probably very upset, probably made a cup of tea myself, made a fool of myself, and and start complaining, of course. And don't think monks and nuns don't complain. Even my teacher, I remember, was so fed up at some point, but the tea was so bad, just for a period of time, that Hachin Sumedho actually asked one of the senior monks to do the tea once, to make tea. In public, so it's not a secret, you know. But with Hachin Sumedho, you tend to think, you know, I don't think he cared that much about a good cup of tea. It's there was always a sense of a teaching somehow, you know, something to learn, because when you express your opinion in such a strong way at the stage of practice he was, you know that he's trying to make a point. At least that's the way I interpreted it. So this kind of capacity to access the world of the mind is, you know, it's absolutely amazing that we can be here just practicing meditation and actually interested in studying the mind. And to study the mind, you have to be prepared to observe and to look and see clearly. Many people are quite frightened to look at themselves. I mean, let's face it, this world is complex and very conflicted and very sometimes totally incomprehensible for ourselves. We just don't know what to do with ourselves. Don't know what to do with this mind that keeps thinking when we want to stop thinking, that keeps sort of being depressed when we don't want to be depressed, that has a capacity to bring a kind of dreams and illusions, you know, phantasm and all that kind of things, when maybe we're not even interested in that. So you realize you're dealing with something, with a part of oneself which is not so easily controllable. You know, it's out of control a lot of the time until we train it. That's called the training of the mind. And so it's called training, you know, not by chance. It's like really studying and starting, you know, understanding what it needs to come to a place of understanding, insight, knowledge. I came across, completely by chance this evening, across a sutta which I had heard about, I knew, but somehow it was forgotten. And I brought it with me. I just brought a few pages that of interest for me tonight. And and it's a story. It's a story of a monk who met the Buddha without knowing he was a Buddha. So they shared a room for one night. I'm not going to tell you all, read the whole story, but they shared a room for one night, and he did not know he was a Buddha, even though he was a disciple of the Buddha, and he was he trained following the teaching of the Buddha, and had not actually met him, so he had no idea that the person who was sharing his room was the Buddha himself. It's quite a sweet story. And there's many things in this sutta that really struck me. One of the things was that perhaps you've heard of the five elements, like earth, water, fire, and air, and then the fifth one being space. And I just heard about the sixth one, which is consciousness. So that's one thing I heard tonight, I learned tonight. And then the Buddha described what is a human being. So he described it in terms of the element, those elements. And then I'm not going to go through the detail of the elements. You might be interested in finding out yourself. But one of the things that really interested me, he says, a person has four, so he's talking about, obviously, somebody who is practicing, you know. A person has four determination. That's a translation of Ajahn Nisaro. So it's not my favorite one usually, but that's the one I found. So he says, thus was it said, in reference to what was it said, These are the four determinations: the determination of discernment or wisdom, the determination for truth, and then the determination for relinquishment, letting go, and the determination for calm. I find those determinations really just reinforcing, in a way, what we know from practice. And so, but it's a good kind of, you could say, it's a good map to what is needed on the path. You know, the determination for discernment or wisdom, panya. That's the way Ajahn Tanisaro translates panya, discernment. The determination for truth. Then that brings you straight back to the foundation of practice, the fourth precept: to be truthful, right speech. Yeah, foundation for truth. And this right speech is dealing with the truth that manifests through from your mind, through your mouth, and through your actions. Then there is aspect of truth which comes from just noticing. Through the Vipassana practice, you are with the five khandhas, for example. You can see them as they are from moment to moment in their transient form, in their impermanent form. You can see, if you practice correctly, the nature, the truth of this mind and body, just at the level of the reality of how it is, you can see it now in the present moment. You know, I'm not saying like under a microscope, a very powerful microscope, you may see the truth of your mind and body as little atomic kind of bits and pieces, you know. Very different maybe from what you see in just looking from, you know, doing Vipassana practice. You know, just sort of normal, not looking at anicca, dukkha, anatta. So there's level of truth, you know. The commitment to truth. And then the determination for relinquishment. Relinquishment is what happens when you don't do anything to your mind. The mind is constantly letting go. The reason why we don't let go, we're not able to let go, and we suffer so much, is because we cause in ourselves. We create a lot of little dams. You know, we are damming our mind here again and again by holding on to things that are painful, pleasant, unpleasant, and so on, both good and bad. We learn the skill in practice. When you study the mind, you learn to see clearly where the suffering comes from. At first, it's not obvious. You think that if you let go of something, you're going to lose your truth, my truth, my opinions. My opinion is true. I think this way, and I think that way, and it's true. Don't challenge me on that. So the Buddha asks us to challenge the mind. Is it true? Is it really true? Some people have made profession of of questioning in that way, like Baron Katie, as sometimes I quote her. But you can do it yourself. I mean, Ajahn Sumedho asks us to, in a way, to investigate the mind in that format. Is it really? You know, are you sure? Is that true? You know, I can only do that. Is that true? I can only think like that. I can only feel like that. I can only perceive like that. That's the way, and that's my truth, and nobody's going to change that for me. So the actual teaching of the the path of Buddhism is enabling us to start questioning reality, what we see, what we perceive, what we feel, what we think, especially what we think. And the way of challenging this and questioning this, it's very simple. The Buddha doesn't make a huge amount of philosophy to justify my opinions. There's not a lot of great, you know, metaphysical theory about why I perceive the world this way or that way, or think this way or that way. There's not much of that, at least in the discourses of the Buddha. It goes right to the point. He starts undoing the whole mechanism of a human being. It's like undoing this construct of me, my personality, my body, including my body. You start studying, you know, your thoughts, your feeling, your perception, your mental formations, your stories, everything, all your experience become a platform for you to start questioning seriously whether what you see is actually founded in truth or not. That's really disturbing, isn't it? Disturbing the status quo constantly. Right? Actually, that's one of the advice of my teacher to myself, I remember. You know, don't follow the status quo, he said. I like Tajan Sumedho because he always makes you feel like your little rebellious tendency could actually be adapted to looking at the mind too. Don't believe it, you know. Don't follow the party line. I think it was more the way what he said is more don't follow the party line, you know, what everybody's thinking. And yeah. But it doesn't mean you don't listen to advice or you don't take counsels from wise elders or people who have some experience. You can also internalize this way of speaking. You know, don't follow the party line of your own mind. My own mind has a lot of party lines, you know. Like I said, being convinced that what I think and the way I do things is the only way, the right way, my way. It's so difficult when you start training the mind. And everybody says, you know, your way is only one way, but it's hundreds of them. When you start the training, it's one of the most difficult parts, is the letting go. Like one of the early nuns who actually passed away now, Sister Rojana first, when she was through an interview for a magazine. People said, oh, you know, Sister, with this life, you know, she was already 50 when I was early, just 30, 31, 32. And the interviewer said, you know, Sister, that must be so hard for you to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning, you know, and the cold and so uncomfortable cottage here, and you have to walk up the hill to go down to go to the puja at 5 o'clock in the morning, and you eat only one meal a day. And in those days, we didn't have breakfast. So, and you don't have breakfast, just a cup of tea in the morning. That must be so hard and so difficult for you, isn't it? She said, she was a wise lady, she said, that was nothing, I can tell you, that was easy. The worst part, it was letting go of my opinions. The most difficult part was letting go, abandoning my personal opinions. Just in case you struggle with your personal opinions. So all the discomfort at the body level, you know, she was not in very good health either. She had asthma and so on. She said that was, you know, basic. She did say that was peanuts, but that was very nothing much compared to having to abandon, give up my opinions, my views. And these views and opinions, when I was talking about the dams that we create in our mind, are very much the bigger ones. That's the one that really blocks the view. You know, when you feel that somebody's challenging you in your view, and you really get very upset. People can get so upset if you tell them, no, that's not right. And you're right. You have all the right to be upset when somebody challenges your view. It's quite okay. It's completely okay. But when you come and do the training of the mind, when you come here to start really kind of examining, you know, discerning the quality of the mind with its mental states, with its emotions, with its you know, past and future stories and so on, then you begin to see how stubborn the mind is, really stubborn. I always say you have to be very stubborn to be a nun, otherwise you'll never be a nun. So when I say you're stubborn, I always add the fact that it's actually a very good quality. Once you purify it, it becomes great determinations, you know. You become very, the stubbornness, if it is still very, you're very identified with, can create a lot of problems and a lot of enemies, you know. A lot of people, if you're too stubborn, it means you're very rigid in some ways, you know. Very fixed, and very, the mind is, has, and this rigidity of mind can be transformed into actually a determination, which is, you know, it's determination implies a kind of ability to flow with life as it is as well, rather than to break in the face of change, in the face of uncertainty, in the face of not knowing, you know. So when you don't know, sometimes your opinions come, you know, headway, like really strong, and say that's how we do it, you know. You're not quite sure what, you know, how to respond to a situation, because you just come with your know, the known of your life, you know, what you know, what the mind knows is going to come first and shoot forward. That's the way we do it. But at some point, you go through, you know, through this study of the mind, you go through also a period where you lose your old self, you know, the old, in Christianity, I remember they used to use the word, you know, you abandon the old man, when man still meant, you know, all human being in the world. Now, you know, it's correct language. You have to be careful when you say you abandon the old man. You just give up your old self, basically, you know. Abandon, let go of your old conditioned self, your old conditioned personality, which at some point we get really bored with, don't you? That's the first noble truth, you know. We get fed up with thinking the same old thing, feeling the same old responses in our life, you know, with the same old stories again and again, trudging through again, fear stories, greed stories, you know, panic stories, attachment, you know, stories, you know, falling in love stories, attraction stories, and so on. At some point, there is a stage in our life when we come to a stage of we feel bored, we had enough. And then very often people end up at Amaravati. It's kind of weariness of the old world, the old me, the old self. You finally say there must be a way forward through that. And that's when you start training the mind in a way, because you know, we are so lucky. For 32 years, I never knew there was this teaching, you know. But there's an intuition. Something in us is intuiting. There must be something else, you know. So people go to God, to Christianity, to other religion, you know, and then suddenly I bumped into something that resemble what I thought and felt was Buddhism, you know. What I had, in a way, almost discovered by myself, but I did not know how to put names on it, the map. I didn't have the map, just a kind of, you know, a sense of something bigger than my little old world. So, commitment to this truth, I just go back to that. You know? Every fortnight, we recite our rules that we commit ourselves to. If we have transgressed any kind of those rules, we have to, if it is a light transgression, you know, a category of light transgression, then we just need another nun to just say it. The other nun is not here to give you a little, you know, hit your head with a little stick. You know, she just hear it. It's like just being accountable, being transparent, being honest, you know. So every fortnight we have that. That's a commitment to truth. You don't know the whole truth because a lot of our life is unconscious, you know. a lot of our life. We don't know everything about our lives. Maybe there are a lot of lives that we don't know yet, you know. But it's not conscious. So the precept on speech has to do, like all the other precepts, has to do with clear intention, you know, intentionally. A lot of things we do unintentionally. Like, you know, if you intentionally step on a poor little ant, you know, we say, I'm going to kill you. That's much more serious than just treading on an ant without knowing it, you know. You can feel guilty and remorseful and all that, but you haven't killed something intentionally. So, commitment to truth. We have this help, this support by having those rules, what we call Vinaya for the monks. We call this recitation for the nuns, just to make sure that we don't overstep the, you know, the what's allowed and not allowed. You know, even some nuns don't feel too happy about being called, calling our rules a recitation, you know, rather than the Pali word, or our groups a community rather than a sangha. But that's little details, you know. In any way, when you study the mind, okay, that element of truth is very important. And I like to continue a little bit on that subject, because this is what caused so much trouble in our lives, internally and externally. You know, sometimes we are saying untruth simply to cover, you know, the ego. The ego is a naughty construct, you know, because it's a survival construct, and it will do anything to survive. Do you understand? Lie, kill, hate, make you miserable for lifetime after lifetime just to survive. So it's not like, it's not clever. It's very clever, survival cleverness, you know, intelligence. And you have to be very careful. A lot of untruth comes through our mouths just to be able to survive as a personality that we know, the old world we know, the old self we know. And if that's all we know, of course we want to survive. If we don't have any other options, who wants to die? Nobody wants to die, particularly. Yet we're dying all the time, mind you. We are dying all the time, as you know. Every moment the cells are changing, we are getting older, and every moment there's a little death. Every time we let go, you look at your mind, you look at the moment, it's dying all the time, it's going. The word die has such an emotional charge. When we say let go, it's just dying. It's the same. But it doesn't have this emotional charge. And it's funny, because I think we should find a word that makes death actually fun. Because it's always charged with very heavy-duty kind of feelings, you know, because we don't know what happened when we die with a physical body. I don't have a clue myself, and I'm not really so interested, to be honest. I'm interested in living now. That's really what I can do, what I can witness, what I can know. Many people would ask, you know, what happened after death? You know, will I be reborn into this place or that place? I say, I don't know, and I really don't care. I mean, politely, you know, I would say, well, actually, I don't really mind not knowing, you know. But the emotion is more, I don't care, because I don't know. But what I remember is a teaching of Rinpoche, which says, do you want to know your future life? Just look at what you're doing right now. It won't be so different. Do you want to know your past life? Well, past life is what's happened in the past. You don't need to worry about it. What you thought a moment ago is your past life. I really like the wisdom teaching, I have to say, you know. They so kind of cut through all the rubbish of complexities, you know. Straight. Future life. Of course, not everybody can speak like this, you know. You have to trust the person, experience, to believe. I mean, not to believe, but to feel, yeah, that's it. Yeah, I trust that. You know, otherwise you say, well, who is he to tell me something? You know, I need to go back to my book, you know, about all the philosophy about the future and all the philosophy about the past in Buddhism and the psychology of the future. And, you know, but your future is what you think, next thought. The past is what you thought just a moment ago. And it's profound, you know, it's not just simplifying things. It's actually the profundity of realization. Don't need a lot of word once you know. So this going back to walking the path and the determination to relinquishment. Next one. Relinquishment, it's the aspect of, you could say, letting go, okay? And, you know, when we talk about ascetic practices, it has to do a lot with just learning how to consciously relinquish certain aspects of ourselves. You know? When the Buddha talks about training, you know, he talks about letting go and abandoning what is unskillful, for example, abandoning what suffering, letting go of suffering, right? Letting go of the cause of suffering, letting go of greed, letting go of hatred, letting go of jealousy, envy, and so on. That's the aspect that kind of being determined, you know, committed to renounce, renunciation, relinquishment, abandonment. So the Buddha speaks in those ways. And then the last one is about commitment to peace, to calm, I like that. You know, because there is a kind of conventional calm, which is manifest when you use a certain object in your meditation, or you calm a very ruffled mind, very agitated mind. There's ways of calming the mind down. And there is a calm also, the peace that comes from letting go, or what is called in the Buddhist practice, the third truth of suffering, Nirodha, right? Letting go, abandonment, cessation of greed, of all these unskillful states of mind. And even if you're attached to skillful states of mind, you know, you have to learn, you study and you learn how to see the suffering of being attached to even healthy states of mind. Any attachment is a limitation of the mind. It's obscuring the mind. It's hurting the mind. Any limitations is not freedom, in other words. It's not freedom of thoughts. It's not freedom of perception. It's not freedom of whatever you want to, you know, express it, however you want to express it. The freedom. And freedom, you know, when you study, doesn't come, it's simple. You know, it's freedom. Oh, everybody lost freedom. Great, you know. Sounds so good, doesn't it? Remember, the 80s, you know, 70s, 80s, freedom. Great, you know, campaigning for freedom. But actually, freedom means also, freedom is a result of having faced experience, you know, gone through many fears in our mind, fears, you know. A lot of our, what makes not us feel unfree, you know, caught up in ourselves, is the fact that fear, you know, freedom, we're frightened to be free. It's too big. It's too much, you know. I'm not saying free, completely free. I'm not talking from my experience of being completely free, but I've noticed how fear can easily really block We have strong aspiration to be free. All of us, every human being wants to be happy and free at some level. But sometimes we don't understand that behind this aspiration, there's also a huge amount of fears, you know. Fear of what will happen if suddenly I am not Françoise, as my personality, French personality, Françoise. What happened when I let go of that? Françoise, I see it as an English accent now. Françoise, who studied dance, you know. What would happen if I stop being the fit person that I used to be? If I can't do what I used to do when I was training as a dancer? If I can't go anywhere I want? Do you know? So we are frightened of abandoning our old personalities. Suddenly you're Chinese and you have to fit in a Western mentality. It's not easy, is it? Or you are Western. When I was in Thailand, if I had to fit in a Thai personality, that was not easy either. Thai cultural response, you know, to have to be, even though the Thai are very, have the capacity to forgive you for most things, you know, when you're a foreigner there. But to be able to sort of change, and the whole training is a constant change, we change constantly. Sometimes it feels good, sometimes it feels dreadful, you know. Sometimes you feel, oh, great, I'm so happy to be on this path. Sometimes you're trudging through your fear, through your dukkha. You're trudging through your kind of totally not knowing where you're going to go. And then you start thinking, I think I should go. It's not fit. I don't think I can be a monk or a nun because, no, you know, too much, too difficult. So this is what happened when the mind is down. When the mind is up, then everything is wonderful. Buddhism, the best. I don't want anything. I want to be a monk and nun forever. That's when you feel happy, usually. It's a mature person who think like that when they are down the bottom, you know, of the pit. When they don't feel so great, when they feel like a lot of things. I mean, a mind can trudge up or conjure up lots of different things, you know, unexpectedly. But one thing I need to talk about is that we have refuges, you know, and refuges are not just a small thing. Refuges is what, to me, keeps me sane, for one thing, because you can always go back to that place of refuge, call it Buddha Dhamma Sangha if you want to, but really it's refuge, that source of awareness, you know, the mindful one. You know, that takes you to being awake, takes you to seeing Dhamma, and takes you to the wish to be with good people, you know? And good people inside as well. You know, they want you to, so wish to develop the good friend, the Kalyanamitta, inwardly and outwardly. You know, when you want to be with that which is healthy and kind and loving and wise in oneself. And of course, when you have this in your heart, you attract them. You attract. You come to Amaravati often. You know, you're not here just by chance. It's because you have also these qualities in yourself, you know, that are attracted to what is good. Whether you're here or anywhere else, that is committed to the truth and the good. So, just to finish about the calm, because that's very important, I find. We don't want to be calm just for the sake of being calm, maybe, because, you know, many of us are kind of not immediately keen on just being calm. You know, we want to be more excited, you know, something more interesting than just being calm and quiet. I'm sure, especially when you're very young, you know, you just want something exciting. Some new practice, some new insight. You want some new countries to go to, a new monastery to visit, like, you know, you haven't found a place of refuge in yourself yet. maybe, I'm not talking about anybody here, but the sense of, being really feeling at home, feeling rested in oneself. But this calm that comes from insight, when you realize that mindfulness, the aspect of mindfulness in yourself, you could say is neither calm nor good nor bad, it's a pretty neutral experience. But what you notice, though, is a restful place. Not what the mindfulness mind sees is not necessarily restful, of course, but it's you develop a relationship with this capacity, this quality of the heart, mind, that knows, and that is already very still, very quiet, very calm. Some people call it the silent mind. There's a famous meditation teacher who wrote a beautiful book on the silent mind, the aware mind. John Coleman is his name. The silent heart sometimes, But it's just the one who knows in the tradition, in the forest tradition, is called Pu Ru. Pu means a person. Ru means knowing, the one who knows. So it's something very important to realize that the mind that is calm is not necessarily the content of the mind that is calm, but is taking refuge in wakefulness, taking refuge in listening rather than reacting and, moving with all your identification. So if you identify with being a good person, somebody says, I saw you eating that cake, behind everybody. So if you're not identified with yourself, you can forgive. Yes, I did that, If you identify with yourself, you want to kind of punch them, So it's not true. It's none of your business anyway, blah, blah, blah. The mind has lots of resources to keep itself alive. So a calm mind is also the result of insight and abandonment of restlessness, agitation, attachments, fear, greed, hatred, and so on. The list is very long. And all the nuances in between. You can read them usually in poetry. The nuances of life, the beautiful nuances of, So I personally appreciate this quietness very much, not because I'm getting older, but because I know that's the only place where you can actually manifest what your heart wants. I can see there's a wish from our hearts, and I don't know, the heart is not anywhere for me, it's not a place. But something almost, maybe the truth in oneself, something that want to be, there's a part of oneself that manifests what is true, what is good, what is loving, what is compassionate, the Dhamma, And it's obstructed by our delusion, our ignorance, and all the long list of stuff that comes, our reactivity, our fear, our greed, our hatred. It's obstructed and it hurts. Because really, the Dhamma in ourselves wants to manifest, the kind of, it's free to come in and out. And it's not free when there's a lot of, anxiety about one, we have the five hindrances, any of hindrances is kind of lodged in your brain, on your mind, then it's not free. You have to bear with that. That's what patience is so important, because if you bear, it's not bearing for just the sake of, gritting your teeth and enduring, hoping it's going to go soon. You bear with it with wisdom. And that means with awareness, through mindfulness, that sees clearly anicca, dukkha, anatta. Once you see clearly anicca, dukkha, anatta, your fear will start abating. Not when you want, necessarily. But if you see that things are changing, one of the main source of our suffering, we don't know that until we are more free, is feeling stuck with something. That's one of the greatest suffering, when you feel stuck. But when you see something, suddenly you realize it's actually moving and coming and going, coming and going. It's like you have opened a window of freedom. You know, oh, I'm not stuck with that forever. You know, it comes and it goes. That's how you begin to let go of fear, when you see this anicca clearly. Then the dukkha begin to abate, because the dukkha is a fear that something is not going to go, is not going to change, is going to be here permanently. And that's really frightening, isn't it? When you have, you're angry with somebody and you think it's never going to go. Well, I had another experience myself when I wanted to bring the anger back and I couldn't. Somebody had upset me really badly in the early years of my training, and I was at a time when I still was into revenge, you know, I mean, quote unquote, you know. She's going to hear from me. I'm going to give her a piece of my mind. This is something I learned in English later on. But I'm going to tell her off, basically. And you know, it was really, anicca really worked. But it was so disappointing emotionally to feel that I couldn't be the same person I used to be when this anicca struck, you know, because I said, I had prepared myself what I was going to say. I was going to tell her off, and I was going to describe what happened to me and how awful she was and so on. When I met this person, I was not angry anymore, and I couldn't conjure up anything. There's no thought coming up. And I was only 33, so it's not like I was suffering from Alzheimer or something. It just wasn't coming up. And I realized, oh yeah, anger is gone. So the thought of anger didn't come up. And I didn't have the wisdom of giving feedback, you know, like feedback. When you do this, this is what I feel very calmly, you know, and so on. Anyway, that's what happened when you don't have these emotions. Then the thought don't come. And so, learning always, many of the training is about slowing down, bringing the mind to a place of calm and quiet. We are training the heart to manifest the Dhamma. And sometimes it just manifests avidya. But you're still starting again to start again, and then you'll do it better next time, you know. And then you might be disappointed. Next time you do the same old thing, same old stupid thoughts, reaction, and so on. And in the training you learn, okay, well, patience, you know. Right, you didn't get it right this time. Well, you try it next time. You know, maybe next time you have more mindfulness, more already you know better that when this situation arises, then you react this way. You have already learned a little bit that you can't stop reaction so quickly. So you become more determined to have this quality of abandonment, relinquishment, this quality of peace, this quality of calm, and this quality of wisdom, discernment, and so on. Right? Your determination to work towards manifesting Dhamma becomes more clear at that time. All your mistakes, all your when you're not successful at something, you know, all the things that you feel you've got didn't get it right. They are the best teachers. You know, they get us on the path beautifully. So don't worry about it. You know, you just start again, little by little. Yeah. So I read them again. Those qualities. There's many things. I mean, when I read this sutta, I was so touched, really, because it suddenly manifested in me a kind of almost like a condensed form of the whole teaching somehow. It seemed to touch the sila aspect, the samadhi, the meditation aspect, the wisdom aspect, all in one very quickly like that. So, the determination of discernment, wisdom, the determination of truth, the determination of relinquishment, and the determination for calm. So it's a good map, isn't it? Just to remember what happened to the mind. Why do we need those determinations? Just ask the question, why? It's good to challenge. The Buddha is always always encouraged people to challenge, to not believe what he says, to not have blind faith, to really see for oneself. So that's why when you're practicing the Buddhist teaching, you grow in confidence, you know, because you have realized by yourself. You're not just, you know, at the mercy of somebody else's opinions. Buddhism is wrong. It's not true. Anicca is not true. Or there's no dukkha in the world. The world is happy all the time. You know, the New Age version of the world is that there's no suffering. Everything is great, you know. Just so that's one belief system, isn't it? To sort of think that if you suffer, there's something wrong. Yes, there is something wrong. You're just in, you know, you're in the hands of delusion. That's what the wrong part of it. If you suffer, it means you're just gone onto the path of avidya, you know. So I leave you on this and hope that you can come across this sutta. For some of you, you might be interested. I don't know. But it was inspired me just to talk about this tonight, even though, well, I don't have the erudition of Ajahn Amaro, who can talk about in depth, you know, it's kind of on the text themselves, you know. I can just pick up a few things like that and relate that to my own experience, you know, which is also very most useful. Sometimes I do appreciate the fact one can go into the text more deeply, you know, and sort of ramifications and all the what you can remember from different suttas is very enlightening, you know. So I'll end on this.